In 1964, Frank Zappa named his band The Mothers. But a couple of years later, when they recorded their first album, Freak Out, Zappa's record company, MGM, was convinced that no DJ would play a band with that name. So Zappa changed it to The Mothers of Invention. But as Zappa says, when it came to getting airplay, their name was the least of their problems. Their music's sexual allusions, avant-garde influences, and noisy anti-everything attitudes were more of an obstacle. Over the last 20 years, Zappa has written satirical rock songs, jazz fusion, and compositions influenced by classical avant-gardists like Edgar Varèse and Karlheinz Stockhausen. Some people think of him as rock's eccentric genius, but others have criticized him for being sexist, adolescent, and condescending to rock music and its listeners. Zappa has had several encounters with censorship. A couple of years ago, he became one of the leading opponents of the parents group which advocated a record rating system to alert parents to sexually explicit rock lyrics. Zappa had a hit in 1982 with the song Valley Girl, which featured his daughter, Moon Unit, doing a parody of the Valley lingo. Many of Zappa's records have recently been reissued on Ryko Disc, and he has a new book about his life called The Real Frank Zappa Book. I asked Frank Zappa what kind of music he was writing before he started the Mothers of Invention.
Well, I started off writing chamber music and small orchestral pieces. And I didn't write a rock and roll song until I was about 21.
But you played in lounge bands too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but that's not music.
What is it?
Well, it's a very low form of entertainment. I'll give you an example of lounge band repertoire. We were working at a place called Tommy Sandy's Club Sahara in San Bernardino. And we were playing things like the Anniversary Waltz, Happy Birthday, and we were allowed to play two twist numbers per night.
Well, given the kind of anarchic and rebellious spirit that you've had throughout your career, did you do anything unpredictable when you were playing in lounges? Or did you just put up with the rules and play those two twists a night and go into Happy Birthday?
Well, it wasn't my band, so I was, I was hired to be the guitar player, and I sat on a stool, wore a white dinner jacket and a bow tie, and shiny black shoes, and sat there and played the chord changes to songs that I detested.
Now, how did you form your own band, The Mothers of Invention?
Well, once upon a time, I got a phone call from a guy that I'd been doing some recording with, and he said he had just had an argument with a guitar player in this band that he was working with. In fact, he had punched him out. And they needed a substitute guitar player for a weekend job, and I went to play with him at this club called The Broadside in Pomona. And I had some laughs, and I liked the band, and I liked the drummer, and I said, well, why don't we learn some original material, because that was, we were basically just playing In the Midnight Hour and that kind of dance music of the period, and suggested we learn some original material and try and get a record contract. The leader of that band was a guy named Davey Coronado, the sax player. And he wisely advised that if we were to learn original material, we would never be employed again. Well, everybody in the other guys in the band wanted to do it, and Davey didn't, so he quit. And he was right. As soon as we started playing original material, we got fired every place.
But you got a record contract.
Yeah, by accident.
What was the accident?
The guy who finally came to see us playing at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Los Angeles had other things on his mind, and he came in and he saw only one song that we played, and based on this one song, thought that he was signing a white blues band.
He made a big mistake, huh?
Yeah.
Well, let me play something from the very first album that you recorded. The album's called Freak Out, and let's listen to an excerpt of it. My guest is Frank Zappa.
It can't happen here. It can't happen here. I'm telling you, my dear, that it can't happen here. Because I've been checking it out, baby. I checked it out a couple of times. And I'm telling you, it can't happen here. Oh, darling, it's important that you believe me, bop, 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 that it can't happen here. Who could imagine that they would freak out somewhere in Kansas?
Kansas.
Who could imagine that they would freak out in Minnesota?
Minnesota. close as I could imagine.
From the album Freak Out, Frank Zappa is my guest. Would it be stretching a point to say that what we just heard was influenced in part by the avant-garde classical music you'd been listening to?
I would say that that's probably a direct linear descendant of Anagramma by Mauricio Coggle.
Which is?
That's a contemporary musical composition that uses that kind of spoken word permutation, perversion, however you want to call it.
Do you want to tell the story about buying your first Edgar Varèse record?
Well, if you want, sure.
Yeah, right. It's not whether you want to, it's when I want to. Right?
Okay. Well, once upon a time, I saw an article in Look magazine that was saying what a wonderful man Sam Goody was. Sam Goody was described in this article as being a genius of merchandising because he could sell any kind of a record. And as an example of his merchandising genius, they referred to an album called Ionizations. That wasn't really the name of the album. That was a print mistake in the article. And it described this album as having the ugliest music in the world. It had all drums. It was dissonant. It was so horrible, but yet Sam Goody was able to sell some of these things. And based on the description of this album, I thought, this is the music for me, and I went looking for it in this little town that I was living in, and nobody had it. And then one day, by accident, I ran into it in a bin of demonstration records in a hi-fi store in a small town in Southern California called La Mesa. And the guy had been using it to demonstrate hi-fis, and apparently, whenever he put it on, he didn't make the sale, so he was willing to sell it rather cheaply, and I bought it. And I was delighted. I'd listened to it. It was the first album I owned, and I used to listen to it all the time. The real name of the album was The Complete Works of Edgar Varèse, Volume 1, and it was on a label called EMS, which stands for Elaine Music Store, and the record number was 401.
You were telling us that the record executive who signed you thought he was getting a white blues band.
Yeah.
What was his reaction when he heard your album Freak Out?
Well, it wasn't that he had a reaction when he heard the album, because he was also the producer of the first album. His name was Tom Wilson. And on the day of the first recording session, I think the first tune that we did was Anyway the Wind Blows, and that was kind of normal, straightforward, 1960, you know, just a little song. And that was okay. And then we did Who Are the Brain Police, and immediately this very strange expression came over his face, because I could see him through the control room window. And he was on the phone right away to New York, probably trying to explain in advance, cover himself for what he had unleashed. Because he didn't know. He was a busy executive. There was no way for him to know what was really going to be in the Freak Out album. He'd left it up to me to do all the preparations in Los Angeles, book the studio time, and, you know, prepare everything. Well, he was flying back and forth from New York to Hollywood. And then on that day, he got the big surprise.
And what happened?
Well, he stood behind us. You know, he fought very hard to get MGM, which was the record company that released the thing, to support it and promote it. And they tried, I suppose, in their own mysterious way to help us have a hit record. But it was kind of it was going against the grain of the company, let's put it that way.
My guest is Frank Zappa, and he's written a new memoir called The Real Frank Zappa Book. In your memoir, you describe the Mothers of Invention as ugly guys with long hair and weird clothes, just what the entertainment world needed. Did you think of yourself as ugly?
Yep. Still do.
Did that affect you a lot when you were growing up? I mean, were you self-conscious about the way you looked?
Well, I think that most young kids are self-conscious about the way they look, but, you know, if you dwell on that for the rest of your life, it gets in your way. You know, you come to grips with it, and there you go.
Well, did the whole kind of freak period help you in that respect? Because everybody was looking really weird. I mean, it was fun to look weird. It was a style to look weird.
Well, looking weird is one thing. Looking ugly is something else.
Mm-hmm. So you thought you were beyond weird?
Well, I think I had the best of both worlds.
Remember the poster of you sitting on a toilet?
Why, of course I do.
Yes. Yeah, I figured you'd remember it. Well, why did you do that?
Well, it wasn't designed to be a poster. That picture was taken when we did our first tour to England. There was an underground newspaper there called the International Times. And the photographer that was sent over to the hotel to take pictures for this story that they were doing said, hey, why don't you just sit on the toilet? I said, sure, fine. So I did. And the next thing you know, the photographer had taken the photograph and he had made a poster out of it and he was selling it and he was making money from it in England. There's a difference in the copyright laws over there, apparently, that if a photographer takes your picture there, he owns the rights to your image and likeness and he can profit from it. And that's not the way it is in the U.S.
So were you angry with him for doing this?
Well, sure. And then because in those days there wasn't very much control over copyright matters, his poster was then bootlegged by somebody in Holland and then bootlegged again by somebody else in Germany. So the next thing I know, there was pictures of me sitting on the toilet all over the world, which was making somebody a bunch of money, but it wasn't me. In fact, if people know my name or know my likeness, more of them know about me from that poster than have ever heard an album.
Hmm. Well, if you had made the money on it and if you had been consulted on it and everything was legit, would you have still objected to the poster? Did you like the poster? Let's leave the money question aside here.
Oh, the poster didn't bother me. If somebody wants to look at me sitting on the toilet, have at it. And if somebody wants to pay for the privilege, why, sure.
Okay. You've done a lot of rock and roll satires over the years, and I want to play one of them. And this is from an album that you did under the name of Reuben and the Jets. First of all, why did you take on a different name to do this?
Well, this was a concept album. It was, here's the concept. Stravinsky went through a period where he was doing neoclassic music. And the idea was to take all the norms and conventions of the classical music and rearrange the norms in order to create some other kind of music. So what I did was take the norms and common practices of doo-wop music and twist them around to make another kind of music. And then enhance this with this imaginary, let's call it scientific doo-wop group, which we would call Reuben and the Jets.
Okay, well, from that Reuben and the Jets album, this is Later That Night. Boom, 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 boom,
boom, boom, boom, boom, you surely must be trying to break this heart of mine. I thought you knew I loved you and we'd share love so fine. But later that night, that lock on my door, my clothes out on the street, don't want my love no more.
Your voice is pretty deep on that one.
Wait, it's not that deep.
Did you like doo-wop?
Oh, yeah. Really liked it.
You did?
Yeah.
Because I can't tell, listening from the records, whether you're parroting out of affection or dislike.
No, I have a big collection of doo-wop records. I like them.
Mm-hmm. You know, you were born in, I think, 1940?
Yeah.
So you were in your teens by the time rock and roll was hitting the charts.
Yeah, I watched it be invented. Mm-hmm. And then I watched it rot away before my very eyes.
Okay, let's compare reactions. What were the first things that you saw being invented that you liked a lot in rock and roll?
When in the earliest days, it wasn't called rock and roll. I think they started off calling it race music, and then it became called rhythm and blues. And then when white people figured out they could make money from this, it became rock and roll. And in the early days, the people who were singing those songs about their girlfriends actually believed in them. These were kids singing about things that were part of their lifestyle, and these songs were consumed by other kids. So there was a certain realism to it that I think is kind of lacking in a lot of the product that's in the market today.
Well, yeah, it's the believed in it part that I really like. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of songs, even with really dumb lyrics, where the singer really believes in it and is pouring their heart into it, and it's like great stuff.
That was the essence of what rock and roll was all about. It had a credibility that How Much Is That Doggy in the Window didn't have. You see, there was other types of music that were available during that period of time.
But musically, I feel like that's something you've really deprived yourself of, because lyrically, like all the songs that you've done, and I don't mean your instrumental compositions, but the songs that you've done are almost all parodies where you're mocking conventions and never kind of pouring your heart out, you know? And I wonder why.
Well, first of all, there's no need for anyone to understand what lives in my heart, if in fact such an organ exists. Secondly, in contemporary terms, I think that it is a despicable thing to do, to earn your living by sharing your personal inner turmoil with somebody else for money. I don't like those kinds of singer-songwriter types who are always weeping about the tragedy in their life. I mean, why? Who needs it? Everybody else has got theirs.
Well, I mean, you don't have to be whining to sing a good ballad.
Well, yeah, but usually they are.
Uh-huh.
That's the problem.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your music in your life. But first, we're going to take a short break. And composer, and why did you disband your first band, The Mothers of Invention?
Combination of economic factors and the idea that in order for the band to develop, it had to rehearse. And there was not much of an incentive for these guys to grow musically. To bring them to a rehearsal place and make them pay attention for a few hours was a major psychological undertaking.
Why?
Why? Because musicians, I think this is probably a genetic thing, they're basically pretty lazy. They like to play music, but they don't really like to work at it too much.
So you gave up the Mothers and started forming different bands for different pieces and different records that you were doing.
Well, that original group of Mothers that was for the first 5 years already had many changes in personnel.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't anything new that I was changing guys. I think there have been over 100 different musicians in the band through the years.
You knew the GTOs, the Girls Together Outrageously, which is one of the more famous group of groupies. Can I ask you what your you were married since, you've been married since 1967, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when there were a lot of groupies hanging around your door, did you want to take advantage of that?
What do you mean? Did I want to take advantage of that?
Well, what I mean is, did you like to have sex with groupies, or did you kind of?
Well,
not,
I like
not,
to have sex, but I'm not particularly fond of having sex with groupies because generally a person who is a groupie has other priorities rather than sex in mind. It's more, you know, kind of a gunslinger mentality, and that's something I don't want to participate in.
So you stayed away from that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I want to play one of your best-known compositions, and this is Peaches on Regalia from the Hot Rats album, and this is one of the many records of Frank Zappa's that have recently been reissued on the Ryko disc label. Talk to me about what you were going through musically when you wrote this, what you'd been listening to then, and what you were trying to put into the compositions you were writing.
Well, Peaches and Regalia started off as a set of chords that were scribbled on a piece of paper, and these chords were played by a four-piece group just as a backing track. And after the backing track was constructed, the original backing track was in three sections. A front, a long middle section, which contained a blues violin solo, and then a recapitulation at the end. And these were recorded in three chunks, and the intention was to edit these chunks together to make a long piece, which would have been 12 or 14 minutes. And the middle part was okay, but it seemed at the end of the day that it didn't fit with the rest of it. So Peaches and Regalia was built in layers. It was one of the first major overdubbing projects that I got into. And it was the first album that I made using a 16-track recorder, which was a brand new piece of technology at that time. And it was just, all the melodic material in it was written in the studio, just pretty much a line at a time, and then either I would play the extra part or Ian Underwood would overdub the extra part. So it was, let's call it an organic composition. It wasn't something where I would sit down and write it all out and walk in with a score.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear the opening of it. This is Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa's Hot Rats album, that's an excerpt of his composition, Peaches on Regalia. You've recently more or less given up the guitar, I understand?
Between tours, I never play it.
Uh-huh. And instead you work with a synclavier.
That's right.
Which is a synthesizer. Why don't you play more guitar?
There's no incentive to do it. So why bother?
You mean no incentive performance-wise or no incentive just when you're sitting home?
If you're doing a tour, you don't want to just be standing there on stage, so you better do something, so then you play the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're not touring, then I'm not a guitar fetishist. I don't sit around and piddle with a thing for hours on end and just sort of express myself. I don't have that feeling.
Mm-hmm. You don't leave your house very much from what I've heard about you, that you really just stay home most of the time and play music, hang out with your family. You don't drive.
That's right.
Why? It seems like an unnecessarily confined life. Obviously, it seems to be the one you want, but why isolate yourself like that?
Well, why go out? I mean, I'm out now. I'm promoting a book. I've got, I'm going to spend this week talking and shaking hands with people and doing all that kind of stuff. So when it's over, this particular job will be done, and then I can go back and do other things that I would prefer to do, like sit around and write music or work with a synclavier or work on other things.
Do you go to concerts or movies?
No. I can watch films on television or videotape, but I hate to go to the movies.
Is that because you're recognized there?
No, I don't mind being recognized. I think most of the people that I run into on the street are very friendly, and I don't have any problem with them. I just shake hands with them, and if they want an autograph, I give it to them.
Then what do you hate about going to the movies?
Well, just to spend the time to sit in a room with people chewing on popcorn, looking at that big thing on the screen. I said, why? Why pay money to do that? It's not entertaining to me.
Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, you became very active in the fight against the Parents Music Resource Group proposals to put labels on albums if there was sexually explicit material in the lyrics. And it was interesting when you went to when you jumped in that fray, you put on a suit and were really kind of very straightforward spokesperson on behalf of the side against labeling these lyrics. And I was wondering what went into your choosing the kind of effect you wanted to make. I mean, you weren't being the bad boy. You weren't being theatrical. Do you know what I mean? You were really being like responsible spokesperson.
Well, what are you supposed to do? I mean, I basically thought of those women as a bunch of deranged lunatics and making proposals that would, in the long run, result in the diminishment of personal freedom in the United States if all the proposals were adopted. And so I had to say something about it. You know, these were things which would have, if it turned into legislation, affect my life, affect the life of my family. And mm-hmm. I didn't see anybody else going out there with a broomstick to chase them, so I did it.
As a father, have you drawn any, when your children were younger, did you draw any limits on their television watching or music listening or the films that they could go to?
No. None at all.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that there are any things that you have been musically held back from doing because of the lack of commercial potential in it, or do you feel that you've done what you've wanted to do no matter what?
Well, I continue to do what I like to do, but whether or not anybody ever hears it is a matter of access to airtime.
Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of things that you're doing at home now that you think most of us probably won't get to hear because it won't get recorded?
Oh, it'll get recorded, but whether or not you will ever find the record in a store or ever hear the record played on the air, that's the question. The material does exist, but whether anybody gets to consume it is a matter of distribution, and it's also a matter of a type of censorship that, you know, seems to be a fact of life in the United States, and it's also a matter of my unwillingness to give payoffs to radio stations to play records.
What do you mean by that? Do you mean literally bribes?
Well, let's just say that there are unusual aspects to the record business that are best left undiscussed.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.